and welcome to episode 65 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, the award-winning Perry Middlemiss.
Oh, dear.
I believe congratulations are in order, Perry. The A. Bertram Chandler Award for Outstanding Achievement in Australian Science Fiction, presented by the Australian Science Fiction Foundation. Well
done. Thank you, David. Thank you. Yes, that was a bit of a shock when I was hijacked on a Saturday morning very early a couple of weeks ago. The award would normally have been presented at the National Science Fiction Convention in Australia, but this year's was supposed to have been in Canberra in early October, but they got clobbered with a snap lockdown around about that time, and so unfortunately the convention had to be online, and they decided not to do the award there. Then they decided to do the award online some week and a half ago, and there were some technical problems and that couldn't go through. So yes, I've known for a couple of weeks but haven't been able to tell anybody, and then things started to come out with a press release last week, so it was very unexpected.
Yeah, well, very, I'm sure it's well deserved. I'm sure.
Well, I'm not too sure about that, but it was very unexpected. But thank you, David. Thank you for the. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the foundation and the people that got the whole award together, and the Ortliebs for coming along to my house on a Saturday morning. And luckily for them, I'd had a shower and was dressed, because normally by that time on a Saturday morning, I'm not. So they were a bit lucky, I think, from that perspective. But, yep, strange day, but there we go.
Indeed. All right, we have some other news of announcements and winners of things. The Booker Prize has been announced, the winner of the Booker Prize for this year, and it went to Damon Galgut for The Promise. Now, he's a South African writer. And apparently, The Promise is set in South Africa during the country's transition out of apartheid, and explores the interconnected relationships between the members of a diminishing white family through the sequential lens of four funerals. Sounds interesting.
It does. Third time lucky for that author. And it's interesting to note that this year's Booker Prize winner and the Nobel Prize winner are both from Africa.
Very good,
which
indeed.
Which is a good thing to see.
Yeah.
Further award news, the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award has been announced. Now, this award honours the best short fiction in the field, that's science fiction and fantasy fields, in a given year. And this can be either a novella, novelette, or short story. And though there's only one winner each year, so they only put out one award, but for anything less than a novel, really. And the 2020 winner is a story called An Important Failure by Rebecca Campbell, which appeared in the August 2020 edition of Clark's World.
Yeah.
Second place went to The Pill by Meg Ellison, which we read and talked about a week or so ago. And third place to Yellow and the Perception of Reality by Maureen McHugh. So I haven't read either the winner or the third place get up, but I shall try to track them down. Probably bigger news for some people was that the World Fantasy Awards were released, announced overnight in the US, which basically meant it was earlier this morning, our time. So only a couple of hours ago as we speak, David.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are for the World Fantasy Convention. I've forgotten where it was held this year. Montreal, that's right, Montreal mm-hmm. in Canada. And they give out awards, novella, short fiction, anthology collection, and a number of others. But the big ones are the Lifetime Achievement Awards, which were given to Megan Lindholm and Howard Waldrop. Now, I know a bit about Howard Waldrop's work, and he is a stunningly interesting author, is all I can say. All of his stuff is nothing less than interesting.
Yeah.
And he's one of those authors that I've heard a lot more about than I've read, so I really need to go back and catch up with a whole lot of his stuff. The novel was won by Trouble the Saints by Alaya Dawn Johnson. Don't know it. Novella Riot Baby by Tochi Onobuchi, which we have spoken about on this podcast.
Yep.
Short fiction, Glass Bottle Dancer by Celeste Rita Baker. Again, I don't know it. The anthology was The Big Book of Modern Fantasy, edited by Anne and Jeff Vandermeer. Supposed to be a very amazingly detailed work that has picked up fantasy stories from lots and lots of different sources, not just your standard Anglo-American European style. They've picked them up from all over the place, which from Asia, from Africa, and everywhere else. So that sounds pretty good. So that were they were those.
Do you want me to do the readings prize?
Oh yes.
I've got it up in front of me. The readings prize has just been announced by the Readings Bookshop, who gives out that prize, and it's a prize for the best new Australian fiction for the year, and it went to Andrew Pippos for his debut novel Luckies. So yeah, that's interesting about migrant Greek American migrant to Australia. Yeah, interesting stuff.
Yep. Anyway, so he that book was also shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award this year. So there we go.
Yep.
And the last bit of news that I want to cover in this piece is that the Hugo voting closes on November the 19th. This is as much a indication for me to get my act together, because that's only 11 days ago as days to go as we actually speak. I have to finish off a couple of little bits of reading, and then I'll be able to get my votes in. So that's good.
All right. Well, speaking of awards, we're going back in time. The Hugo Time Machine. We're going back to the year of 1967. Do you want to tell us about where the Worldcon was in 1967, Perry?
Right. Well, the Worldcon in 1967 was Nikon 3, held in New York, so the third World Science Fiction Convention held in that city. And it was held between the dates of August the 31st and September the 4th, 1967. The professional guest of honour was Lester Del Rey. The fan guest of honour was Bob Tucker, who also made it out to AussieCon in 1975. The attendance was approximately 1,500 people. They didn't keep really tight numbers on that, so the amount that the attendance is really only approximate. Now, the Hugo Awards for 1967 cover works published in the calendar year of 1966. And they made a slight change this year, David, from the ones that were in 1966. You may recall that in 1966 they had basically the Novel Award and Short Fiction Award. This year they added a third category, which they refer to as novelette, but actually covers novelettes and novellas.
Yeah, it's a strange. I'm not sure. Do we know the actual word counts they allowed for those categories in that year?
No.
Because it's a bit strange. Some of the short stories seem a bit long, and some of the novelettes seem a bit short to me. I haven't done the actual counts.
I think they sort of stretch things a little bit. But look, I had a look at the short story nominees, and I think that while some of them seem long, as you recall, short stories are supposed to be under 7,500 words.
By our standards, yeah.
And so I think some of them may have got to that point or got a little bit longer. But anyway, they just added them all in. And it seems that they just decided to go for novelette and novella together. As you recall, the Nebula Awards, which we will mention as we go along in this discussion, were still staying with the four categories: novel, novella, novelette, and short story. And in fact, the Hugo Awards in 1968 decided to mirror that approach and went for the same four categories as well. We're just in that transition phase at this point, and I think they probably just decided, let's not say what they decided on, because all they did was that we can only go with what we know, and what we know is there are three fiction categories that we need to deal with.
And they allowed a lot of nominees, didn't they? There's, what, eight or something in the short stories? And
they did. What have we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 or 9.
Nine in the novelettes, yeah.
Yeah, there's about nine in the novelettes, and there are
six novels?
Six of the novels. Yeah. Well, novels are now up to six as well. Oh, but all the categories in the Hugo Awards are now up to six. You can only nominate five, but they include the top six. There's a long story behind that, but it's basically to do with stopping people having slates of stories that all get nominated by exactly the same people. But for whatever reason, they seem to have jumped up quite a lot in terms of their nominees. There are some rumours about what happened in terms of the nominations and the stories that appeared on the final ballots for all of these categories, but I did a bit of research and I can't actually track it down, so I'm not going to come up with that. But there seems to have been... There's rumours about there being some changes after the fact. But anyway, we can...
We don't know.
Only look at what we can see and what we can go with.
Yep.
So I'll handle the short stories, David.
All right, sure.
And I'll have a look at them from what I consider the short stories to be from the least best, worst up to the winner. And then you and I can have a chat about them, and then you and I can have our choice about which one we thought really should have been the winner.
Indeed.
If that's different from what actually did win.
Which it might well be. Yes. It might well be.
Okay, so starting off with the short stories. The first one is Mr. Jester by Fred Saberhagen, published in IF January 1966. And this is one of the author's berserker stories. It's supposibly a comedy, but... It's really not very funny at all. And it's just, you know, nothing really.
Yeah,
so, I think it just got on because it was a berserker story. Mm. Next one up, Delusion for a Dragon Slayer by Harlan Ellison. It's another story of Ellison's that shows a lot of promise, but really doesn't deliver very much.
I've yet to read one of Ellison's stories, which I like, I remember. But there you go.
Well, look, you know, the... Repent Harlequin said the TikTok man, which won the short story category last time, was an okay story, but it just wasn't as good as a couple of others that were around.
I didn't do much of it. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. Keep going.
No, that's okay. The next one I've got is Rat Race by Raymond F. Jones. Now, there's a number of authors you're going to come across here which are you don't really know much about. Jones is one of those. He was flirting around in the mid-60s, but I've never really tried to track down exactly how much work that he did. But anyway, so... This is another one of Analog's series of stories that Campbell was publishing about at that time, about the ills of computers. And mostly they are told in fun. The basic idea of these stories was really starting to wear a bit thin by the time we got to 1966. Now, this story concerns the problems of computers being too tightly programmed, not being able to differentiate between a creative process and a standard one of production. And there's also a mild anti-communist theme here, which would have appealed to Campbell as the editor of the magazine. It's an adequate story, but not much more. Mm. Didn't really think a huge amount of it. The next one I have is The Secret Place by Richard McKenna. Now, this was the winner of the 1967 Nebula Award for Best Short Story. So there's some crossover here, which is good. I'll read a bit about this because a bit of a synopsis of this story, because it did win the Nebula Award, and therefore it needs at least a little bit of attention paid to it. So during the Second World War, the narrator of this story, Duard Campbell, was one of a number of geology students tasked with exploring and mapping an area of desert in Oregon. Now, it is believed that a young boy found a deposit of uranium oxide in the area before he was killed. So that's why they're there doing the mapping. But after the mapping is complete, Campbell is left behind by the team to give the impression that the project is still continuing. Sounds typically, you know, bureaucratic. And he engages the boy's sister, Helen, to act as his secretary. And through her, he learns that the two siblings had constructed an elaborate imaginary fairyland in the desert. And as he joins Helen in driving around the desert, he slowly begins to understand what happened to the boy and how the two of them interacted. This is a very light story with little new to say. Maybe McKenna won the Nebula because the film adaptation of his novel, The Sand Pebbles, was in cinemas at the time, or maybe it was because he just recently died.
Hmm.
I believe that it was found in his desk.
Yes,
after
it was
his
a posthumous
death.
Award, yeah.
Yeah, it was a posthumous award and posthumously published. And it appeared in the very first volume of the original anthology series, published under the title of Orbit, edited by Damon Knight. So it's interesting to see those original anthologies starting up in the US around this time as well. I didn't think much of this story. It was okay, but light.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Okay. My next one is Man in His Time by Brian W. Aldiss. This is a bit funny because really it was originally published in 1965 in the UK, but didn't become available in the US until 1966. Therefore, it was included in the 1967 ballot. All a bit strange. Now, this concerns the only survivor of a mission to Mars, who has mysteriously reappeared on Earth with no idea of how he got back here. In addition, the effects of the interplanetary travel have impacted him in a very strange way, as he now appears to be living, got this, 3.3077 minutes ahead of standard Earth time. It's a very, really strange concept.
Yeah.
And the story details the toll this takes on him and his relationships with his family. It's, it was written by Aldiss, and Aldiss was really pretty top of his form around about this time. And so it is, again, nothing less than an interesting story and one that is worth checking out.
Hmm.
A bit strange.
I quite liked it, yeah.
Okay, next one I've got is Comes Now the Power by Roger Zelazny. This deals with, well, the main character, and this is a gentleman by the name of Milt Rand, who is a telepath whose abilities have somehow become blocked. He can't communicate telepathically at all. And he's only ever met four others like him, like himself in his time. And try as he might, he cannot seem to rekindle the flame of his telepathy. So he wanders his hometown at night, desperately seeking an answer, searching with whatever powers he's got to be able to try and make contact with somebody. And then one day he hears a voice in his head, which is another telepath, but which is very faint. And he follows that up, and it's what happens to him and this other telepath that's described in this story. And this is one of the great telepathy science fiction stories of all time, in my view. This is a cracker. I like this one a lot. So the top, and we're down to, I have this as third.
Okay.
The next two probably are right up there. Now, the interesting thing about this particular story, David, is that it was first published in the Magazine of Horror in winter of 1966 and 67, and then reprinted in an Australian-edited anthology called Beyond Tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Seems familiar.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds familiar to a certain other person that I happen to be talking to who had a story in that collection.
Indeed he did.
If that is correct.
Yes, it's my first published story.
Well, there you go. So there's a nice connection between the two.
Mm.
There you are. My second last story that I'm discussing is Light of Other Days by Bob Shaw, out of Analogue, August 1966. This was nominated for a Nebula Award for Best Short Story, and it's the story of Shaw's that introduced his concept of slow glass, that is, special glass that slows the speed of light passing through it, which basically means that on one side of the glass will show the light that hit the other side certain predetermined time previously. So it could be 5 years, could be 10 years, could be a month. In this particular story, a couple are on a road trip in Scotland and they drop into a farm selling 10-year glass windows. So that is the time taken for the light to pass through it is 10 years. And these are of very high quality because they are specifically aligned to the local time zones. So that is, you can put a piece of glass in your living room and for the next 10 years, it will show what happened on the other side of the glass 10 years previously. So at night, you could, some people who don't use their local glass will have the glass up there so that they can see a daylight scene during the evenings. Or if they want extra light during the day, they can have that showing something. If they're living in a high-rise apartment, they could have a scene of the ocean or cows crossing a paddock, anything that's going to be there. Anyway, though, this is a very interesting story of Bob Shaw's. An excellent story. And yeah, basically, he went on to write a number of extra stories in this, using this particular concept of the slow glass.
Yeah, he really plumbed the concept to its depths. And some, as you say, some very clever stories in the series.
Well, it certainly was, and it was certainly a very original concept for Bob Shaw, because nobody else had ever thought about this one at this stage. And then we get to the winner of this particular category, Neutron Star by Larry Niven. Now, this is a story set in Niven's Known Space series, which was really starting to kick off in the mid-1960s. Probably reached its peak in with things like Ringworld about 5 or 6 years later, which won the Hugo Award for Best Novel. Anyway, this is the first of Niven's stories to feature Beowulf Schaefer and the nearly indestructible General Products range of spaceships, and their creators, the Pearson's Puppeteers. Now, these puppeteers are a strange alien race that looks like a beach ball with two arms, with three legs, two arms sticking out of them, with eyes and a mouth on each of the arms, which act as their manipulators and fingers. These become very, very important in Niven's Known Space series, but you have to really know what's going on further down the track. Now, the Pearson's Puppeteers are the ones that develop the General Products range, and they've had a problem in that one of the ships that they have built, and which was carrying two human pilots, has somehow been impacted by a force outside where the pilots inside have died. Now, these indestructible General Products spaceships are supposed to be exactly that. They're supposed to be such that the only thing that will pass through the hull of the ship is visible light. And so you can see out, but nothing outside should be able to get in. No X-rays, no gamma rays, no lasers of any description. And so Schaefer is engaged by the puppeteers to reenact the flight that caused the death of the two original pilots. And that is to undertake a flyby of a neutron star. So this story was written just after these stars had been hypothesized, but before they'd ever been discovered, which was a couple of years later, I think. And so the puppeteers aren't going to do this because they are renowned for their cowardice, so they always get somebody else to go and do the work for them, and then they take the credit. Now, from a distance of 55 years, the semi-lack of knowledge about neutron stars seems a little quaint, but you have to think of it as being the time in which it is written. But this has got a lot, the story's got a lot going for it. It's a space opera with a scientific puzzle at its heart. It's got strange aliens and a human hero who wings out in the end. It's a basically classic sense of wonder stuff.
Yes, yes.
And on a personal note, this is probably the first SF author I discovered that my father had not heard about, because this particular story was published in IF magazine, and I don't believe he read that. He only read mainly Astounding. Now, the other thing about this is that, well, I can tell you about it because I have to, because the reason why I want to criticise it is because of the basic concept of this.
Yes.
And because the story is now close on 60 years old, I think you basically people should have read it. If they haven't, well, sorry, here's a spoiler coming up. The reason why the original two humans were killed was that they found themselves at the wrong parts of the spaceship as it got very close to a very high gravitational field, such that the tides that were trying to pull the General Products spaceship apart actually tore them apart inside the spaceship. Now, Schaefer starts to realise and to understand what's going on. So he gets himself very quickly into the very centre of the spaceship and is then able to survive the trip. Now, the whole thing, this was that theoretically the reason why the puppeteers didn't know about tides was because they lived on a planet without a moon. But that, of course, is silly.
It's not credible, is it at all?
It's not credible because it doesn't make any difference wherever you are, either on a moon or not on a moon.
You should know about tides.
That tides are there anyway, and they would have seen it somewhere else because they have done a lot of travelling. Now, tides are, as we know, David, are not necessarily just created in water. Tides also occur on the moon, so that our moon flexes backwards and forwards. And the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, of course, flex markedly under a large gravitational field, to the extent that the gravitational force being impacted on some of those small moons has meant that they still have a molten core after all this time, when theoretically they should have been basically cold rocks by this stage. So Niven, this was pointed out to Niven that, you know, he basically really messed this up and hadn't really done it properly, but he decided to get to cover that up later on in a story, a little later story called Ghost, where it's explained that the puppeteers really did know about tides, but wanted to keep that knowledge a secret, so that, just like everything else about them, because they're scared that anybody that finds where they live will come and invade them. Look, I do like Neutron Star, even though it does have problems. It is, as I said, a classic Sense of Wonder space opera story, and one of the best of its kind, as long as you get away from the original.
Yeah, you have to suspend your disbelief.
Tides and so on.
But I mean, here's quite a nice explanation of why tides occur in the story. So that's, you know, he understood all about that sort of stuff. It's just the business about whether the puppeteers were ignorant of this, which is, as you say, just not credible.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a pretty good story apart from that.
So what were you thinking of the short story nominees, David? Which, if you were to have your choice as to which one would win, which one?
Well, I very much like Light of Other Days because of the clever concept. But yeah, if I put Light of Other Days first, I'd probably put Neutron Star second. I must say that we skipped by talking about the Harlan Ellison story because I said how much I disliked it, but I thought that was one of the worst. I had it down at the bottom of my list, I think. It was one of the worst stories I've read. You know, this boring middle-aged guy gets squashed by a construction ball and wakes up in some sort of dream or paradise or something where he gets to live as a hero in this dream world and then totally stuffs it up. End of story. Okay.
Well, that's why I skipped over it.
It wasn't worth even talking about. But anyway, no. Yes, that was terrible. So that's probably where I put it. I don't know that I'd rank the others in any sort of particular order, but yeah, the Ellison would have got to the bottom of the list, I think.
All right. Well, I would have done the same, I think. I would have plumped for Light of Other Days because I think it's a beautifully written story and it's a wonderful concept. I would have had Neutron Star second, yeah. Comes Now the Power third, I think.
We say, actually, thinking about it, I would have put The Secret Place third. I actually quite liked that, this story. Okay. I thought it was a clever concept and interestingly dealt with. But anyway, that's fair enough.
Different strokes.
Well, I'll roll on to the novelettes, so-called. So let's see. Well, there were a couple of these stories which I have to confess I didn't read. I read part of the way into them and just couldn't bear it. And I just started skipping page, skipping, skip, skip, skip. And when I get to that point, I give up. So that was The Alchemist by Charles L. Harness. It's sort of a nonsensical thing about using alchemy in a commercial chemistry company, I think. I couldn't bear it. And then I discovered that one of the other nominees was another story by Charles L. Harness, which apparently is set in the same commercial company. So I skipped that straight away. Missed that one entirely.
I read this one. You didn't miss anything.
I didn't miss anything. I'm good.
It's a long, boring story about a patents lawyer. And that's it. And there's even a note in the introduction to the story is that it would be very good if any reader could find any genre interest here. Well, I couldn't find any. No. I wondered why it was published in analog in the first place. Really weird.
And then we got The Manor of Roses by Thomas Burnett Swan, who wrote a lot of fantasy novels, some of which are fairly charming, but I didn't much like this one. I found it a bit tedious and a bit confusing. It's set in the Middle Ages at the time of the Children's Crusade, and features a couple of young boys, one of whom's the son of a noble and one of them's a sort of peasant. And they sort of set off to join the Children's Crusade, but they get intercepted when they come across this manor full of roses. And there's all sorts of stuff about mandrakes being dug up, and they're actually living creatures that scream when you dig them up, and people cut them up to make love potions and things. But apparently these mandrakes can sometimes impersonate human beings, and they've all become Christians. By that stage, I just gave it up. No, I got three quarters of the way through that. All right. Then we move on to Call Him Lord by Gordon R. Dixon, who wrote a lot of military-type SF, didn't he? So this is about the son of an emperor, the emperor of the galaxy or something, who has been sent to Earth to get a bit of an education and get to know the original planet of humankind and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And he's taken around by a guide or a bodyguard to show him places. And this emperor's son is a complete spoiled brat. And by the end of the story, I'm going to give it away. At the end of the story, the bodyguard kills him and goes back to the emperor and says, here's your son back. He's dead. And why did you kill him? Was it because he was a spoiled brat? No, because he was a coward, apparently. So, okay, that's it. End of that story. Didn't think much of that at all.
Well, it won the Nebula Award for Best Novelette.
Yuck. Mm. Yeah. Then we go to another Roger Zelazny story. He was all over the place, wasn't he, Zelazny?
Oh, everywhere, yeah. Yes.
Anyway, and this is called For a Breath I Tarry. And I looked that up, and it's from that quote, For a Breath I Tarry, is from a poem called A Shropshire Lad, very well-known poem, by A. Houseman. I won't quote the thing, but it's kind of about how someone comes together from the 12 corners of the sky, and it's I couldn't get this one. It's sort of a retelling of the Book of Job, with mechanical intelligences as being the subjects of the more superior power, sort of setting them some tests against each other. And this particular main protagonist is this mechanical intelligence called Frost, who lives at the North Pole, and he becomes obsessed with human beings who are now extinct, and he becomes very interested in those, and eventually he manages to recreate a human body that he's going to enter and control and become human. And it sort of ties up with the intelligence that was looking after the South Pole, being positioned at the South Pole and looking after the Southern Hemisphere. And all they sort of get together. It becomes a kind of Adam and Eve story. Yeah, it's confusing. I didn't like it much.
I agree with you on that one.
Then we have a story called This Moment of the Storm, again by Roger Zelazny. Now, this is a better story, I thought, but really, it's all about a severe storm happening on an alien world. The protagonist is someone who travels between the stars, and in this particular timeline, there is no faster than light travel. So, as you travel between the stars, you're constantly, because of relativistic effects, you're constantly losing track of other people. You're aging very little, whereas everyone on the planet you've left ages much more rapidly. And you, if you go back to the planet, everyone's really old. You meet the grandchildren of the people that you used to know. But he's settled down on this particular planet, and he's sort of settled in. But this huge storm hits, and there's a lot of good description of the impact of this storm, the flooding, lightning, all that sort of stuff, interesting stuff. But he's got a lady love in the story. He's wanting to marry. And right at the end of the story, after they have a few experiences with dealing with this storm, this young woman is murdered by a looter. It happens all in about, 20 words. She's killed by this looter, and the protagonist goes, oh, okay, oh, well, and decides to travel to another planet. End of story. Didn't think much of that either. So I'm not being very kind to Zelazny this time around. Anyway. Next on my list, this is worst to best, in my opinion, which I think I'm tossing up between this one or the other one being the second in my list. But anyway, we'll go with this one. It's Apology to Inky by Robert M. Green Jr. And I like this. I like this a lot. It's kind of an interesting story involving mixed up timelines or overlapping timelines, if you like. So the story is to do with a man whose, when he was a young boy, his dog called Inky was killed, run over by a car. And apparently he took some sort of revenge on the lady who ran over this dog. And we don't know quite what this revenge is, but he's very uneasy about it and he feels guilty about it. And so we start with a viewpoint of him as a middle-aged man, and he's seeking to try and find out the truth of what happened. And he meets up with the woman's daughter, with whom for a while he had a romantic relationship. But as part of the story, he encounters himself as the young boy. And you sort of see from the boy's point of view, this middle-aged bloke meeting up with him and asking strange questions. And he meets the older guy, meets this woman he had romantic feelings for in a cafe. And while they're there, he sees himself as a young man and the woman as a young woman at another table in the cafe, and he's sort of watching them with fascination. And then they sort of go outside, and there's this really old guy and a really old woman pull up in a car, and it's himself again. It's an interesting, surrealistic sort of story. I actually liked it a lot. It was very cleverly done, I thought. Okay, so the second on my list is The Eskimo Invasion by Hayden Howard. I like this too. There's an anthropologist who's studying a new tribe of Eskimo near the North Pole, but there's something strange about this tribe, and they're kind of keeping him there. He keeps trying to get away, and they make excuses as to why today's not a good day to travel, and he's sort of starting to feel trapped, and he sort of escapes from them because he's discovered something about them, and that's that they reproduce. Their gestation period is only 1 month. They get pregnant, and the baby's born within a month after that. And he starts to get the feeling that there's something alien about them, and they're not quite right. And he starts to understand that because they reproduce so rapidly, they could overwhelm the earth, which is what, in fact, the tribe of people say that they're going to do. They're here to, you know, populate the earth. And he gets injured and he ends up in hospital, but he can't convince anybody else of the threat. And of course, all the authorities, the Canadian authorities, are saying, oh, well, you know, there's this tribe of people there. We have to support them. They're not getting enough food and so on. We'll take them food. Yes, they're reproducing very rapidly, so they obviously need a lot more support and supplies and so on. He's trying to tell everybody, no, don't. So, but anyway, I liked it. I thought it was good. And then we come to the winner, which I think was a deserved winner, which is The Last Castle by Jack Vance. Well, I'm a big Jack Vance fan anyway, so it's no surprise that I thought it was a good choice. So I'll try to not talk too long about it, but I will like to outline the basics of the story. It's set in a far future time when mankind has spread throughout the galaxy and the Earth was abandoned and sort of desolate. But 700 years ago, a small group of humans returned to Earth, bringing with them a number of alien species, which have kind of been domesticated to act as slaves or living machines. These include the birds, powerful flying creatures of limited intelligence, but who grumble about being asked to do any work. The peasants, who are farm workers. The fanes, who are sort of gorgeous creatures reminiscent of female humans. And the mechs, technicians and couriers, and other kind of work they do. And as the story opens, the mechs have unexpectedly revolted against the pampered last humans on the planet, and they're laying siege to a castle called Janil, which they break into and destroy, killing all the human inhabitants. Most of the humans are, however, too superior and refined to pay much attention to what's happening, right up to the point where they're killed. According to Jack Vance himself, the idea for this came to him when he was reading about the history of Japan and the social interactions of a highly formalized society. Superior individuals in that society wouldn't deign to consider the activities of the common people, couldn't even sort of use the same language about what they might be doing. They literally couldn't conceive of thinking about what the workers might be doing. And that's kind of the case here. So one final human castle remains, the last castle of the title, the castle of Hajidorn. And despite what's happened to the other castles, which they've heard about, the humans there also very disinclined to do much about it, in a total state of denial, though it's clear that they're going to be next. Now, the closest we've got to a protagonist is the human called Xanten, Xanten, who very reluctantly decides to take some action by investigating what the Micks are doing and why they're doing it. So on his travels, he encounters some groups of expiationists who are humans who have turned their backs on the refined life of the castles and are living a rural existence without the aid of the Micks. Things go on, and Xandan captures a Mick who was leading a group of rebels, and eventually he works out from talking to this Mick that the Micks have a sort of joint intelligence using a sort of form of telepathy, and they are rebelling because they fear that the humans are going to send them all back to their home planet, which apparently is a dismal place compared to Earth, and the Micks have decided, therefore, to kill all the humans and make Earth their own. Now, Xantan eventually leads the humans who walked away from the cities, the expiationists and a few others, he leads a group of them to defeat the Micks, and then he settles down to a happy existence with a young woman who he's met when he was travelling away from the castle. And it's one of the very rare instances in Jack Vance's fiction where the protagonist has a happy ending with a female character. Jack Vance, I think, excelled at world-building, or rather, not so much world-building as society-building. And this is a very good example of that, and I thought very thought-provoking. And there's lots of interesting metaphors when you think about it, of things about how we're currently thinking about dealing with the pandemic, how we're thinking about dealing with climate change, so much denial and so much wanting not to think about it. I thought it was an interesting story.
I agree that The Last Castle should have been the winner in this year. The rest of them were, at best. I think Vance's has done a very good job here. The thing I found interesting about this particular category in this particular year is the stories that didn't actually make the list.
Mm.
I didn't go into any of the ones out of the short story list because, well, frankly, I think the ones that won there, A Light of Other Days and Neutron Star, were probably the pick of the bunch. But I think The Last Castle might have had a bit of a run for its money, mm-hmm. if some of these others had been put onto them and all put onto the ballot. So I'll start off with the ones that that I know about. The Wings of a Bat by Pauline Ashwell. It was written and published as by Paul Ash in Analog May 66, which is a novelette. You probably aren't aware of this, but it made the front cover of that issue of Analog. And it deals with the first team of scientists sent back in time to the middle Cretaceous period, where they adopt a baby pterodactyl after it's orphaned. And the story follows the attempts of the team's doctor to feed the animal and teach it how to fly, which later helps us save her life. Well, this is an excellent story. Never come across it before, just happened to find it this time, but I thought it was very good. There's a novella by Samuel Delaney, who, when you think about it, you really are looking here, as you mentioned earlier about Zelazny cropping up, and as he did in 64 and 65 stories, and here he is in these 66 stories. And Delaney was the same. I mean, he was really starting to hit his straps about this time, as we'll find out a bit later. And he published a novella called Empire Star.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a couple of others, which I really cannot understand why they... I can understand why one of them didn't. I can't understand why the other didn't. We Can Remember It For You Wholesale.
Oh, yes.
By Philip K. Dick. Mm. Fantasy and Science Fiction, April 1966. Mm. It's a novelette. Now, this is Dick's classic story about memory implants, which was made into the woeful Schwarzenegger film Total Recall. So forget that. But go back and have a look at this. And it's a cracker of a story.
Yeah, it's good.
This is the one about how this guy's always dreaming about wanting to have gone to Mars. And so he goes and gets a memory implant, only for them to find out that they can't implant it because he really has gone to Mars. And then he says, oh, he wants to do this and he wants to do that. And everything that he wants to do is already done. And it's only when they find out later on exactly why he's had all these memories repressed. Oh, wonderful story. I like it. Yeah. I really like it a
good
lot.
Good story. Yeah, it's amazing that didn't get
Didn't get on the list. And the other one is Behold the Man by Michael Moorcock.
Oh, yes.
Which was published in New Worlds in September 1966.
Great story. Maybe because of the religious worries that people would have about it, don't they?
No, shouldn't be that, because it does appear on the 1968 ballot.
Ah, okay, interesting. So why?
because it was published in New Worlds in September 1966, and most of the people in the US were not seeing New Worlds at all. So either they weren't subscribing to it or didn't know about it or weren't reading it, didn't get a look in. And the reason why it ends up in the next year's ballot, or is it, no, just, maybe it's not on the Hugos, but it's on the Nebulas. The reason why it ends up on the Nebulas next year is because the story was finally published in one of the world's best collections, either the Merrill or the Waldheim Cars, and therefore was published in the US and therefore was eligible for a Nebula Award. Because, of course, remembering at this time that the Nebula Award is only for stories published in the year in question in the US.
Yeah.
Again, that's where we have this problem, that the Nebula is not a whole world award. It's only for the USA. And the Hugo is for the whole world, but people just didn't see it. Maybe they had seen it and decided, no, they weren't going to have it for that particular reason. Don't know. Anyway, if I was having a list, I would have both We Can Remember It For You Wholesale and Behold the Man. Both of them are fantastic stories and ones that people should know. But I think they got the right, overall, I think they got the right winner from this particular ballot with The Last Castle by Jack Vance. Good to see.
Yeah. Before we move on, did you notice that in this same issue of Galaxy magazine that The Last Castle appeared, it's immediately followed, and therefore I read it, it's immediately followed by a book review by Algis Budrys. He did a whole series of book reviews for Galaxy magazine. A review of a book called Dune by Frank Herbert.
Let me tell you,
he has some critical and pretty insightful things to say about it. So it's well worth having a look at that in that magazine.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I might get back and have a look at that and see where that is. All right. Yeah. I mean, I actually think that Budrys was a better critic than he was a writer, but that's
probably a fair thing to say. Yeah.
There are other people around that basically really liked his stuff, but I haven't really read anything by him that's really...
Some of them are very good, though. I mean, I like Rogue Moon, as you know, and I like Who is very good.
Who I haven't read, so maybe I should go back. That's 1950s?
Yeah, it would be.
All right, okay. All right, so therefore we're done with the novella. Now, don't forget that, as we said in here, that this was the novel and novella categories for the Hugo, covered both. And so on the ballot, you had Call Him Lord, which won the Novelette Award, Nebula Novelette Award, and The Last Castle won the Nebula for Best Novella. So Vance got a double prize that year, so that's good. Call Him Lord was, as you said in the in your discussion, look, it's okay. It's a classic analogue story in my view, but, you know,
appeal to Campbell, yeah.
Absolutely. You can see that. Anyway, so let's move on to the novels, and I'll start. There are six of them, and I'll start. Go from my worst to my best, or go from my worst to my winner, and then we'll discuss which was going to be the best. Now, the worst of the ones that we have here is I have down is Day of the Minotaur by Thomas Burnett Swan. He's already been up where David talked about The Manor of Roses, which appeared in the novelette category. But this is another, this is a fantasy novel that uses Greek mythology as its base. And it's told mostly from the point of view of the Minotaur on Crete. And this is a Beauty and the Beast romance of sorts. It's interesting, but not really to my liking. I'm not really a big... if I was heavily into Greek mythology, I think he probably does a very good job of it, but it's not really for me. Now, the next one, The Witches of Carrere by James H. Schmitz. This is rather interesting for a bit of a reason, and see if you can guess it at the end. This novel originally started as a novelette published in Astounding magazine in 1949, and has since been reprinted many times. And then was added to it by the author with a couple of other novelettes or short stories, and came up with this final novel of The Witches of Carrere. This is a space opera in which a captain of an ageing but fast freighter, rescues three children with psychic powers from an evil empire which is hunting their homeworld. Later on, they encounter and have a battle with a world-sized battleship commanded by a robotic being in black armour. Does this sound familiar?
Yes.
Sounds exactly like Star Wars.
It does.
And there's a lot of the plot of Star Wars in this particular novel.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to come across this now after all this time, because I had never heard this mentioned in the discussions of Star Wars when it was out. I know that Lucas took a lot of his ideas from the Japanese films of Kurosawa, but I think he basically picked up a whole heap of things, and he may not even have remembered where he read some of this stuff.
Well, that's true.
Where he came up with it. So anyway, it's an interesting thing for that perspective. Number three, Too Many Magicians by Randall Garrett.
Oh, yes.
This is the only novel written by Garrett in his Lord Darcy series of stories, but he also published two collections of shorter stories in this particular series. Now, the series is an alternate history where the John Barr point, and the John Barr point is the point of divergence from accepted line of history, so where things branch off from our line of history to this alternate history. And this John Barr point here occurs when Richard the Lionheart of England does not die of his wounds in the Crusades in 1199, because he was shot in the shoulder with an arrow and it became gangrenous and he died. But he recovers and returns to England. So because of his return to England, there's no King John, there's no Magna Carta. And as a result, the Plantagenets line, of which he was a member, still rule a very imperial empire. And they rule a large Anglo-French empire. And along the line, there's been no scientific revolution, but rather a magical one, but along the lines of science. And so this is the stories in here follow Lord Darcy, who is the Emperor's chief investigator. So he's brought in to investigate when things are really weird or involve magic or involve the aristocracy. Because he is an aristocrat himself, he is able to question other members of the aristocracy, and they really have to answer him. Whereas if it was just your fly-by-night inspector, they just tell him to get lost and that'd be it. So it's a very interesting group of stories. And in this particular novel, set in an alternate 1966, and that's the other thing, all of the stories are set in the time in which the story was published, but it's completely unrecognisable from our own world. And this is in an alternate 1966, where Darcy's called in to investigate the death of a wizard at a wizard's convention. This is a classic locked room mystery where the victim is found stabbed to death on the floor of a locked room. And there are no magical residues anywhere to be found. And so how did they die? I mean, you would automatically think that a wizard that's killed at a wizard's convention, or a magician that's killed at a magician's convention, would be killed by magic. Not in this case. And look, it's light stuff, and it's a good combination of fantasy and crime fiction. That's good stuff, and I really like these.
I
like these a lot.
Yeah. What I like about them is that he actually takes his premise very seriously. You know, once you've got that premise, he sticks to it religiously, and it's not a parody of the Sherlock Holmes stories. It's quite a straightforward, clever use of the concept, I think.
There's a lot of hints and pointers to sort of classic detective stories, like the Holmes and Watson stories. There's the Nero Wolfe stories with Archie Goodwin. There's sort of, because Too Many Magicians is a bit like Too Many Chefs, I think is the title of one of the Nero Wolfe stories. So there's a lot of bits and pieces there that float around. And I guess the more you know about the history of England and France, and the more you know about classic crime fiction, the more you're going to get out of this. But that's good. But you can read it without knowing that and still enjoy it. But the more you know about the other things, the more enjoyment you get out of the novel. So it's sort of done on a number of levels, but it doesn't talk down to you and it doesn't diminish your enjoyment if you don't know about that sort of thing. So, look, as I said, I like them. Always have.
Yep.
Now, I'm in a little bit of two minds about the next two, because Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes and Babel 17 by Samuel R. Delaney were co-winners of the Nebula Award.
Yeah.
And I went through and read these about a month apart and gave them my normal rating about what I would normally do, and found out later on I gave them exactly the same rating of 4.3.
Yeah, there you go.
So I can't really separate the two of these. So I'll talk about Flowers for Algernon first, because that just happens to come up on my list first, and then I'll talk about Babel 17, and then we'll move on to the winner for this particular year. Now, Flowers for Algernon is an expansion of the 1959 short story or novella of the same title, which won the Hugo Award for Best Short Story in 1960. This particular novel, Flowers for Algernon, was later adapted in 1968 into the film Charlie, for which Cliff Robertson, who played the lead role, won the Academy Award for Best Actor. In other words, this whole thing is pretty good story material. Charlie Gordon, as the main protagonist in this particular novel, starts off the novel with an IQ of around 68 and is chosen to undergo an experimental surgical procedure aimed at raising his intelligence. The novel is told in a series of diary entries written by Charlie himself as he charts the changes he experiences, both intellectual and emotional, following the surgery. Now, the Algernon of the title of this book is a mouse who has experienced the same procedure prior to Charlie and who acts as a measure against which Charlie can chart his own progress. This is a wonderful piece of technical writing by Keyes, as Charlie's spelling, grammar and style changes along with his intellectual development. So as he gets further along, it gets more and more complicated and you get more of an idea about what Charlie's doing, and he starts learning new languages and then can't understand why people that he talks to haven't read all of the literature. And so he says, well, it's written in Hindi. Yeah, so don't you know Hindi? No, says one of the other guys. Well, maybe you should, says Charlie, who knows about eight languages by the time he gets through the middle of all this thing. But this is an emotional roller coaster. It is an emotional roller coaster that Charlie experiences along his journey, and that's what makes this book so compelling. It's a very, very interesting book, almost experimental in style in some ways. And normally you don't get point of view. Well, there's nothing else like this in terms of point of view diary entries. It's something that's rarely used in science fiction. Maybe it should be used more, because it does a wonderful job with this. The next one, Babel 17 by Samuel R. Delaney. Now, this is supposedly a space opera novel, but as with Delaney, there's always a but. There's always something else in it. Now, during an interstellar war, the invaders, as they are called, have developed a new language, which they refer to calling Babel 17, which can be used as a weapon as well as a form of communication. Now, this is uncovered by Ryder Wong, who's a linguist, poet, and telepath, and she is then recruited by the Earth People's Alliance government to decode Babel 17. So a bit like the Enigma codes in the Second World War, they believe that if they are able to decode this particular new form of communication, they'll be able to work out what the invaders are doing and maybe get ahead of them. But as Wong delves deeper into the language, it becomes clear to her that it is changing her perception and thought processes. As she goes along, when she's in this particular spaceship where she's attempting to get through to a spot where she can get more information about the language, she's been suspecting there's a traitor on a ship, and later discovers that it's herself.
Mm-hmm.
She hadn't even realised it was herself. This is a very innovative space opera that concentrates more on the human element than military
yep.
hardware or technology, which is a good thing. And the novel is an exploration of that Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, that is, that language alters thought and perception, which was recently also featured in the 2016 film Arrival, based on the story of your life, which I thought was an excellent film, by the way. And also, as I said, also deals with this. I want to quibble with this particular novel in that Wong's language skills seem rather overdeveloped. She seems to be able to pick up this language and other languages very quickly, and she uncovers the solution much faster than you might expect. But the quibble's only minor, really. The novel dazzles with inventiveness. It really is a worthy winner of the Nebula Award, and so I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great book, yeah.
So
can I just say I thought it ended a bit limply. It didn't quite end positively to me. It's all seemed to wrap up far too quickly and without the whole concept that this very strange, very very powerful language has been developed by humans. I was actually looking forward to it being some sort of alien species or alien computer or something that had come up with this, but it didn't turn out to be that way. It was just something invented by the invaders. So that was, yes. I thought that was a bit disappointing.
But anyway. You find out the Earth People Alliance are humans, and so also are the invaders. You think first off they are actually aliens because you don't ever get any concept of them, really, for a long way through the novel, and it's only later on that you come to realise what's going on, so...
But yeah, it's good, a great book.
Now, the winner for this of the Hugo Award for Best Novel for 1967 was The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert A. Heinlein.
Boring.
Now, the interesting thing about this, David, is we discussed this last time we did the Hugo Time Machine because it was on the ballot for the 1966 awards. How did that happen, you may ask? Well, the reason why we're postulating is that the novel was serialised in IF magazine starting in December 1965, so therefore it got started to be published in 1965, but finished in April 1966, so therefore it was eligible in 1966. Well, it may well have been this particular novel at this particular instance where it appeared on two ballots in two consecutive years, where the rules regarding this were changed. And so now, if a book is serialised in a magazine, it is only eligible in the year in which the novel is completed, which makes a lot more sense. Because if you say, well, I'm only going to read stuff from 1965, you've only read the first section, the first fifth, if you like, of this particular novel. So you can't judge it on that. That's not the full novel. No. You have to wait until you get the full thing, which was in 1966. So anyway, here it is. It won.
I don't know whether we need to go through this.
Well, I'll give you a bit of a rundown. It's basically the battle between the moon and the earth. That's it. No, I'll go on a bit further. So basically, the moon attempts to gain a level of independence. The Earth, of course, is not prepared to give up its colonies so easily, and a battle ensues. And Heinlein pushes his idea of how a revolution can be run and won, and also his concept of a self-regulating society, which is rather naive in my view. Anyway, the interesting thing about this particular book is that it acts as a sort of midway point for what Heinlein was doing between what he'd done previously and what he was going to do after. And this is the piece where it seems to sort of move more over into the stuff later on. It's a book that's worthwhile reading.
It's one of his better novels, you've got to
say. It's probably his last good novel.
Yes, I'd say so.
How about that? How about we say it's his last good novel? The ones that follow are, well, I don't know, bloody awful, really. The couple before were a bit sort of so-so. So this is his last major one. And it won the Hugo Award.
Oh, well.
For best novel.
There you go. Who are we to judge?
Well, we are.
We are judging, aren't we?
Because we are judging it, and we're our readers. So if I was to go back and look at these particular six books and have a look at them, yeah, as I said when I was talking about it, I really struggled to pick between Flowers for Algernon and Babel 17. If I was going to choose one, and you told me that I could only choose one, I would go for the Delaney.
Yeah, me too. 17. Yeah, for sure.
But only just, only by a smidge, because I think the Daniel Keyes novel Flowers for Algernon is pretty damn good, and certainly one for people to read. Other possible nominees for this particular year, David, before we finish up. Mankind Under the Leash by Thomas M. Dish, which was an expansion of his shorter work, White Fang Goes Dingo, which I think is a great title. Anyway, there's that. Make Room, Make Room.
Oh, Harry Harrison.
By Harry Harrison. Made into...
Silent Green.
Green, that's the one. Two novels by Ursula K. Le Guin. She'd only been writing short stuff up until now. Planet of Exile and Rodcannon's World. These are not early my favourites of her work, but they are early, early stuff. She was getting into her stride. World of Tavs, or Tavs, whether you pronounce the P. I don't know whether it's got a silent P or not. This is by Larry Niven. And Mind Swap by Robert Sheckley.
Interesting.
So I think that really, when it comes to it, the Flowers for Algernon and Babel 17 are the two standouts in this particular year. They are both excellent works. Moon is a Harsh Mistress is so-so. And that's where we are.
Yeah, sure.
So, all right. Right, so that's the end of the major awards. The other awards, do you want to go and deal with the other awards?
Just very, very quickly, because I'm going to have to go fairly soon. Yep, the dramatic presentation went to an episode of Star Trek, The Menagerie. I don't recall that particular episode, do you?
No.
No, doesn't matter.
No.
Best Professional Magazine, IF. Best Professional Artist, Jack Gaughan, which is interesting because he also won Best Fan Artist the same year. Interesting. He's a great artist. In fact, he illustrated The Last Castle very nicely. Best Fanzine, Nierkas, which I don't know that fanzine. But interestingly enough, that year, Australian Science Fiction Review was nominated in that category.
That was edited by John Bankson.
John Bankson, that's right.
First time an Australian fanzine that had appeared on the ballot.
Yep.
Ever, I believe. Yeah.
And the best fan writer went to Alexei Penshin, who I recall the name, but I don't remember much of what he wrote.
He came back and won a Nebula Award for best novel in the early 70s, Rite of Passage, I believe it is. So we may get to that one in a year or so. Never know.
Indeed. Yeah. Right. Okay, well, I think that covers that year pretty thoroughly.
I think it does. I think we got through all that. I wouldn't go out of my way to say that it was a great year. It had some highlights. But as I said, it's just odd that there's a couple of the better shorter stories for the year didn't make the ballot. But there we go.
There you go. All right. I think we might wind up there, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. We're going to talk. We're not sure what we're going to talk about next time round, but probably just
we'll
what we've been reading.
We'll see what comes up.
Been reading some interesting books, so it'll be interesting to talk about those.
It might be. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
All right. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
See you then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.